Good morning. Welcome to Radio Linguistica this Tuesday afternoon. We are very happy to have with us James Archibald, who's actually in Montreal, which is why I would say good morning, Mr. Archibald.
Good morning, good afternoon, whatever.
Yes, yes, across the ocean. You are a senior faculty at McGill University, in particular in the Translation Studies Department, and you're a researcher in communications, translation, jurilinguistics, and glottopolitics. And you recently took part in a virtual conference mid-October entitled Access for All Plain Language. You sent a little bit of information on that, but could you please tell us what was this conference about and who the drivers of the conference were?
The conference called Access for All Plain Language was in fact the first virtual conference organized by Clarity International. Clarity International is a group of people, both in practice and in research. And these people are very much interested in the issue of plain language. The conference was sponsored, if you will, by Clarity International, but it was also co-sponsored by the Center for Plain Language and the International Association for Plain Language, which basically promotes the use of plain language in both government and the private sector, and also in the parapublic sector as well. So this conference was, as I said, the first virtual one held by Clarity.
What's Clarity?
Clarity is an international association which focuses on the use of plain language and the promotion of plain language. And it was very much involved, if you look at the background of the association, in the promotion of plain language in the United States from a legislative point of view. And so with respect to the relationship with PLAIN, which is the United States organization, Anita Cheek, who was the founding director of PLAIN, was very much involved in the work leading up to the adoption of the Plain Writing Act in the United States, which was adopted under the Obama administration, with a view to ensuring that all federal regulations and all federal legislation be written in such a way so as to be actually understandable by the people who are affected by the legislation. And this was probably the first time in the United States that this has actually taken form of a piece of legislation. One can trace the origin of this back to the early days of the Republic in the United States, when President Madison insisted that legal documents be written in such a way as to be intelligible and applicable and usable, et cetera. And then many presidents subsequently have iterated the same thing, including President Truman, including even President Nixon, surprisingly enough, to do this. But it was only under President Obama that this actually took place. And of course, it is more or less applied. But anyway, that's another chapter in the history. That's simply part of the dynamic behind the whole movement.
But the movement is not a governmental initiative, right?
No, it's not a governmental issue at all. It came out of the NGO sector, in fact. And the focus is very much on language management, in the sense that it isn't purely a translation issue. and it isn't purely a terminological issue. And therefore, it focuses more on governance rather than anything else, because no matter what area of government or the private sector you're working in, it's important to focus on how language is actually managed and what the actual workflow process is. So that for those of you who work in the European Union, especially at DGT, one of the major issues there is workflow. How do you actually manage the workflow when you're dealing with communication problem, you're dealing with a translation problem or an interpretation problem, et cetera. And so there's very much a community of interest here with translators, interpreters, people who manage communication, and so on. And the other angle, which I think is extremely interesting, is the angle which relates to language variety. As you know, language variety is a very contentious issue to find out what languages we use, what varieties of languages we use, what in fact is a language, because language can in fact extend to sign language or can extend to, in some African countries, to a form of language called clicking, etc. So it becomes rather complicated. But the point is that one of the other issues that we're working with in ISO, the International Standards Organization, is to actually define a process whereby we can actually define different language varieties and to decide how they're used. So that when we go back to the plain language issue, the common interest here is to make sure that we adopt principles of plain language, notwithstanding the language variety that's used. And so that's why the plain language standard is supposed to be language neutral. And that, of course, is another chapter which has to be explained in great detail, but that's the ethos behind it, if you will.
The title of the conference in full was Plain Language is a Civil Right. That's not a very common focus in the language industry, even though, of course, especially in the legal domain, we're all aware that the law is addressed to somebody. Now, this concern, what is plain language in exactly? And what's the history you mentioned? Of course, American history, but there's more to it. Several countries have had a kind of history to the approach of, well, how do you call it plain language in French, by the way?
That's a good question. So that, in fact, there is a center which was established here in Montreal, in fact. And it's a center which is called the Centre de Lisibilité. And so the concept is lisibilité in French would be basically actually the ability to read a text and to actually understand it. So that the terms langage clair come up and lisibilité come up. So for those of you who are linguists in the audience, what is important to look at this is a semantic field, and there are all sorts of interrelated connections here. And the semantic field isn't cut up exactly the same way in every language. And so when we talk about plain language in English, in fact, the background to that comes out of what was initially the plain English movement. And I'm always reminded of Jane Austen, because when Jane Austen was growing up, she had a grandmother. We all have grandmothers. And Jane Austen was visiting her grandmother at one point in time and had to explain an issue to her grandmother. And her grandmother spoke to her in a very direct fashion and said, Jane, just tell me in plain English. So the point is that people want to hear explanations of things in plain English. So that why? So that they can understand. So the plain English movement, if you will, in the English speaking world, morphed into the plain language movement. And that took form in the English speaking world, mostly from a dynamic point of view, mostly in the Southern Hemisphere, in Australia and in New Zealand, where governments actually started to adopt policies which were compatible with plain English or plain language, etc. And then as it internationalized, one realized that this has application in other contexts as well. So that not only being plain English, it has to be plain language. And so therefore it morphed into a language neutral type of orientation. However, even though that tradition, I mentioned Jane Austen sort of as a sidebar, but you can trace this back, in fact, to the court of King James when it was decided, especially with the emergence of the Anglican Church, to make sure that religious documents, and especially the text of the Bible, were available in a language which people could understand. And at that period in time, we talked about writing in such a way so that the, quote, plowman could understand. So that meant that we had to bring things down so that even people who were not well educated could actually understand a text.
Are you suggesting this is a Protestant influence?
No, not necessarily. But there certainly is a, I suppose it's probably a sense of reformation behind it. And it makes me think, actually, because during this is another aside, but during the conference that we just had with Clarity International, Laurent Romary, who is the chair of TC37 with the International Standards Organization, spoke at the conference in one of the panels dealing with the emergence of the plain language standard. And he used the expression, we must, quote, and I'm quoting him, we must spread the gospel. So I don't know if Laurent is a Protestant or not, and I don't care, and no one else does either. But the language which he used is very much in that spirit of Reformation, if you will. However, in the French-speaking world, this tradition also goes back to the Ordonnance de Villers-Cotterêts, which clearly at that point in time under François Ier. Was set up in order to make sure that legal texts are actually understandable.
And so the king to his subjects.
Yes, absolutely. Now, there's a huge debate among sociolinguists right now as to what this actually meant. But the point is that notwithstanding the debate among sociolinguists, the most important part of that ordonnance, or that decree, if you will, was to establish the legal principle that legal texts, no matter what type of legal text you're dealing with, should be written in a language that people can actually understand. And this links with what we refer to as legal consequentialism, in the sense that If the law cannot be applied and people can't understand how to apply the law, of what worth is it? So this is very much rooted in that tradition as well. So it's not only something which is rooted in the English speaking language or the common law tradition, but it's something also which one finds in a civilist type of environment, in civil law jurisdictions, going back to texts like the one which I just mentioned, adopted under the reign of François Premier. So I think there's a certain universality in this concept, which is important to bear in mind. And that is probably one of the reasons why it's important for the International Standards Organization to come up with a standard which would be possibly applicable from a universal perspective.
And I suppose this is what you mean by civil rights. And if I read you correctly, that is the right to understand and to
understand
language, and perhaps as a sign of a modern governmental approach, I mean, to a modern constitutional order where people are full-bodied citizens.
Yes, it's very much linked to the concept of citizenship.
Yes.
And not only responsibility of government toward the citizens, but also the responsibility of all members of civil society with regard to their compatriots and to other people who are subject to laws. So I think if we go back to the objective which the conference set for itself, if I go back to this conference, the conference very much focused in the different panels that we organized on three different areas, which I think are really interesting from a plain language point of view. The first being, how do we break down sociocultural barriers when it comes to communication? Secondly, given that many of the legal texts that we produce are opaque and ambiguous, sometimes purposefully so. So the other issue is, how do we disambiguate these texts? And the third issue that came up, which I found extremely interesting, which is very much in tune with the legal orientation, is if we write in plain language, one of the purposes is to protect certain citizens or certain people. And the people that we're interested in protecting are what very often we refer to as vulnerable persons. And so in legal terms, it's very important for us to understand what in fact is a vulnerable person, or who is a vulnerable person, and how do we actually protect them? So if you look at those three angles, it is quite interesting to look at the plain language movement is as a movement which will work toward the elimination of sociocultural barriers, which will move toward greater clarity, in other words, the disambiguation of legal texts, and finally making sure that all people are protected under the law.
All people or vulnerable people?
Yes, as one of the colleagues from South Africa pointed out in the conference, is I actually asked him the question rather pointedly, because it's something that always bothers me, because legal texts very often refer to vulnerable people or vulnerable persons. And as in all ISO documents, we try to define terms to say, what do we actually mean by this? So I put the question to him and I said, so what, and I put it to him, especially because the fact that he's a jurist. And I said, so what do you call a vulnerable person? So we had a fairly long exchange about this question. And finally it boiled down to the statement which he made, which I found extremely interesting. He stated that, in fact, we are all vulnerable. And that vulnerability is something which depends on context. And so if we look at society as it is today, depending on your language background, on your racial background, on your ethnic background, your cultural orientation, your religious background, et cetera, your physical state, many of these things, people are vulnerable to different degrees. And so his point of view from a legal perspective is that, quote, we are all vulnerable. Some people are more vulnerable than others, but from a legal point of view, we must make sure that our texts protect all people, notwithstanding the degree of vulnerability.
I suppose
you can imagine how that plays itself out in the COVID-19 type of situation where we have different vulnerable segments of the population.
Yeah, and where plain language is indeed very much wanted. So should we, for example, consider ourselves to be sort of the weaker party whenever we are facing contracts, we are facing the law? I mean, the authority is not on our side as citizen, consumer. Should we consider ourselves as citizens as well? Weak side of the arrangements, whatever it is, that need to make sure that we understand, and who need people to take on board this need. That is, I suppose, translators or whatever, explainers, people who care to make the law accessible.
Mm-hmm. There's one category of employee, for instance, which we mentioned, is a plain language interpreter or a plain language translator. Clearly, if you look at people who are employed by different companies or governments, etc., there's probably not a category of a plain language interpreter or a plain language translator. But that is one of the things that came out in the discussions, is that, in fact, there's a new subset, if you will, of professional behavior, which is encapsulated by that type of descriptor of a plain language interpreter or plain language.
Would you say that?
So sorry, just if I can follow up on your question then in terms of weakness. So when we had the discussion about vulnerability, there was another person taking part in the discussion who is not a lawyer, not a translator, but basically a social activist, if you will. And this person is a rapper. So very often we don't translate into rap. But his point is that people who can understand rapping or rapping language they constitute a public, an audience. And very often people who use that particular form of language, and we find it in the French-speaking world, we find it in the English-speaking world and other language groups as well, said very often the people who use that form of expression are, quote, weaker. And so if we can take texts and make them accessible to people who can understand more readily a concept if it's expressed in rap, then we're approaching that particular segment of the population and we're helping those who were, quote, weaker. So it's very interesting to see that point of view from someone who is not a translator and someone who is basically a social activist. From that perspective. So the vulnerability part is also something which we have to look at from a point of view of power structure. Who has power in a society? Who is weak in society? Who is dominated? Who isn't dominated, etc. And I can imagine that you can think of scenarios, and especially in the current situation in the United States where there's racial strife or in fact in France, where there are sociological differences and divergencies which cause a great deal of disruption in society.
I
won't cite the specific examples, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. If I return to this idea of opacity, ambiguity of certain language, to the way in which our societies sometimes function on insider language, rather be a case, insider, what you call entre-soi, plain language is obviously working on that, where you have to open up a little bit and take on board your audience. And of course, there are areas of greater tensions even then. Now, you mentioned plain language interpreters and translators. Have you come across the linguist category? I mean, in these reflections, in this conference, are the translators and interpreters, I mean, in the ordinary sense of the word, active in these reflections on plain language standards?
To be quite blunt, I would say that the major motivation comes from the legal community. And the next group would be the people who are involved in communication management. Translators are interested, but I think they are not the main drivers behind this. There clearly are exceptions. And the one exception that I'd like to cite would be Nicole Fernbach, who is active in the French-speaking world with her Centre de Lisibilité. And she's a practicing translator and clearly sees that this is an important issue in the translation community. And the other person who is probably very important when you look at the history of this situation is Jean-Claude Gemard, who taught at the University of Montreal and also at the University of Geneva. Many of you know, probably. And Jean-Claude, jokingly, he likes to call himself le père de la jurilinguistique, the father of jurilinguistics. And I know that when one of the courses that I give in the legal translation program at McGill University, we use as one of our basic texts, one which is co-authored by him and by Nicolas Cassira, who is now a judge on the Canadian Supreme Court, who was at that point in time a professor in our Faculty of Law. But those are two people who were, speaking of Nicole and of Jean-Claude, those are two people who are very much rooted in the translation community, but who were prime movers behind this plain language campaign as well. So the issue of disambiguation was important to them as translators, but there's a community of interest because it's also important for people who are communicators and for people who want to make sure that the law is applied in a just way and that people have access and that their rights are respected. So there's a whole convergence of interest in this area.
It's so, the issue of effective rights, which is part of the concerns in the European ambit. You know, you have rights, declarations of rights, etc., but you must, how do you ensure that people effectively enjoy these rights? Otherwise, it's dead letter.
Well, it's quite. So if this actually comes up in the discussion that we had at the conference as well, because there is, I can't remember the name right now, but there is a group in Brussels which is an agency which specializes in what is called communication juridique. And that, sorry, I have the reference here. The major mover in that group is Florence Colz, C-O-L-S. And she has written a very interesting article dealing with the access to criminal justice and the issue of what is called the letter of rights, or in French it's called the déclaration de droit. So that, for instance, when someone is arrested, they have to be, as we say in colloquial English, you have to read them their rights. And this déclaration des droits, or this declaration of rights, which should be read when someone is arrested, has to be written in such a way that it is understandable. Because most people who are arrested are vulnerable to some degree. Or they may be weak to some degree, depending on how you define these terms. And so it's important in that initial declaration that people understand that anything that they say may be held in evidence against them.
Well, thank you for mentioning criminal justice, because of course in European law, at the very moment when European law took hold of criminal justice, having no competence up to then, which is the Lisbon Treaty, it adopted two directives. You mentioned one in 2012 on the right to information in criminal proceedings, and the directive 2064 on the right to interpretation and translation, which, okay, this is criminal justice, but we have seen a movement towards opening up the harder core of the judicial system in a way. Now we have reached the end of our session. I must say there's not enough time.
We've only scratched the surface.
I know, but it's 30 minutes. The rule of the game is a bit difficult. Unless you have a final mention you want to make, we would have to declare the session over. I know there will be next steps, working towards an international standard, working with the people in Geneva, and teaching as well.
Yes. Basically, to wrap that up quickly, the Clarity International adopted a proposal in plain language. This proposal was brought to ISO in Ottawa at our annual meeting in 2019. We formed a committee at that point in time to look at developing a standard. I had the privilege of being a member of that committee from the outset, working with Christopher Bamford from Australia and with Laurent Romary. And we were supposed to meet in 2020 in Bangor in Wales in order to develop this further. We've been working virtually from that point in time. We're now up to, I think, maybe the second or third version of the standard, et cetera. And theoretically, if all goes well, we'll be meeting again in Brussels in 2021 when ISO meets and all of the committees meet, etc. And by 2021 in Brussels, hopefully, we will have an actual working document of a final version, which we can present to TC37 for adoption. And hopefully, by the time we move into 2022, we'll have, on the one hand, either a guideline or a standard. Which then different entities, whether they're in the private sector or the government sector, can adopt and can become ISO certified in plain language. So that's our trajectory at this point in time. And as we say, inshallah, we'll make it to the end and we'll be able to succeed. But clearly we are surrounded by lots of well-intentioned people, and hopefully we'll meet our objective.
Very good. You keep us informed, please, somehow.
With pleasure.
On the next steps. Thank you very much. And very good luck for everything coming up now.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Have a good evening.
You too.